what book we're in, right?
Songs.
Oh. Y'all are rubbing off on me. Job chapter 17. As you probably have figured out, this was John McCarty's week to preach, but they're gone, and so we did a little swapping. So I've got today, and he'll have the next 2 weeks. So we don't always just have true alternations there. Job chapter 17, last week we looked at 16, and these two chapters are two chapters that it takes for Job to answer Eliphaz, and that spoke in chapter 15. So chapter 16 and 17 are the answers. We looked at chapter 16 last week, and we'll kind of continue that thought this morning. In studying the book of Job and in preparing to preach, especially these middle 20 or so chapters in the middle of the book, it's difficult, at least for me, it's difficult. I don't want to find myself repeating the same thing over and over, but sometimes it seems like that the dialogue between Job and his friends is endless. And there are different thoughts, and hopefully we've been able to bring those thoughts out, the difference in the thoughts out. But it's been difficult for me just in preparing. And this week has been by far the worst. The text this morning seems to be disjointed. It seems to be that Job's having trouble keeping his one train of thought. And I don't know if that's the case or if it's I'm having trouble keeping one train of thought myself. I don't know, but I have found that the best way for me to study any scripture, any text, anywhere, but especially here, it's just repetition, just reading it over and over and over again. This chapter, reading this chapter 20 times, 30 times, whatever it takes to get the feel for what Job is saying, to get a feel for how he feels. And maybe I'm successful at that, maybe I'm not. But last week, I thought that the gist of what Job was saying that is Job had just lost hope. Job was just beaten down. And you remember last week we talked about that, just a person who is just whipped. And we see those type people in our lives, around us, people who are just beat down. And I think that was the way Job felt, and I think that that thought, that feeling continues in this chapter. But it's a little more disjointed, or it seems to me, than the last chapter was. So let's think about that thought as we read our text. So Job chapter 17, beginning in verse 1. My spirit is broken, and my days are extinguished. The grave is ready for me. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes on their provocation. Lay down now a pledge for me with thyself. Who is there that will be my guarantor? For thou hast kept their heart from understanding, therefore thou wilt not exalt them. He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children also shall languish. But he has made me a byword of the people, and I am one at whom men spit. My eye has also grown dim because of grief, and all my members are as a shadow. The upright shall be appalled at this, and the innocent shall stir up himself against the godless. Nevertheless, the righteous shall hold to his way, and he who has clean hands shall grow stronger and stronger. But come again, all of you now, for I do not find a wise man among you. My days are past, my plans are torn apart, even the wishes of my heart. They make night into day, saying, the light is near, in the presence of darkness. If I look for Sheol as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. If I call to the pit, you are my father. To the worm, my mother and my sister. Where now is my hope? And who regards my hope? Will it go down with me to Sheol? Shall we together go down to the dust? So you can see, if one thing is obvious from reading the text, that Job is feeling hopeless. Job is despondent. Job is depressed. Job is in despair. I've entitled the message, The Death of Hope. When hope, we have no more hope. When a person comes to the place where all hope is gone, how do they think? What do they look like? What kind of initiative do they have? None. There have been times in the past few years that I have just watched people. And it may have been people on the street, on a TV program, some kind of documentary or something, or it may have been sitting in the car somewhere, we're just watching people go by. You know, I don't know if y'all are like this or not, but occasionally Susan wants, when we're out together, she wants to go to Penny's or Belk's or somewhere, and I have to stay and guard the car. You know, I can't go in with her. So I watch people. And maybe then. But there are times that I have seen young people. You know, I'm talking 18 years old, 20 years old, that seem to have no hope. We had a young, compared to me, he's a young man with Lloyd Blanton here a few, 2 or 3 months ago, that told his story. I had seen that guy for the last 20 years, occasionally in the lumber company. I mean, it wasn't the first time I had never met him, but I'd seen him in there. I mean, I knew who he was. I didn't know much about his life. But from what I saw of him in the lumber company, I never would have dreamed the extent. I would have imagined a little bit of a hopeless state, but not to the extent that he shared with us. A young man, probably in his 20s at the time, or early 30s. I've seen older people in their 50s or their 60s or their 70s that seem to have lost all hope. That seem, you know, when you're a man, I think it's common for men when they're in their 20s or 30s, especially in their 20s, to think, you know, they've got their whole life ahead of them. I am invincible. I mean, they don't say that, and they wouldn't admit to it if you ask them. But they don't think anything bad is going to happen. They think things are going to go well. They think they're going to be successful. They think nothing, there's not going to be any accidents. You know, if they did, they wouldn't, you know, drive 90 miles an hour on a motorcycle or in a car, or they wouldn't rappel off of a cliff or do all the exciting things that young men do. But sometimes, as time goes on, and as time goes by, and they are unsuccessful in this, they are unsuccessful in that, and they begin to be beat down either by the circumstances in their life, or maybe circumstances in their families, or whatever it is, and slowly but surely, hope is drained away from them. And they spend the rest of their life just going through the motions. I don't know what Job was like before all these tragic things happened to him. But it seems like very quickly, and I don't know how much time has passed between the time that Job was afflicted and where we are at here. I would think at least 2 weeks, but maybe 2 years. I mean, I just don't know. But in a short span of time, whatever initiative Job had, has been quickly drained from him. Job is at the point where his hope is dead. He says at the beginning of this chapter similar things that he said in the last chapter. My spirit is broken. My spirit is broken. I remember as a young man having young children and reading books about child rearing, books on how to gain a little wisdom and training your children, teaching young children, raising children. They made the distinction between breaking a child's will and breaking their spirit. And it's one thing to break their will or to conquer their will and training them to do what is right. It's a far more serious thing in the process to break their spirit. And Job is at that point. My spirit is broken. You see, the first point I've made on the outline is loosely tying loose ends. And this is sort of a play on words, and it's not necessarily what I think Job is doing. But Job appears to think he's at the end of his life. And a person who thinks they are at the end of their life, if they're physically able to think, if they're physically able to contemplate how much time they have left and how that time needs to be spent, a lot of people will be conscious of tying up loose ends, of getting their, what we call their affairs in order. We've heard that phrase, getting their affairs in order. Job talks a little bit that way in these first five verses. The first three or four verses, he's talking to God. And Job doesn't appear concerned about getting his will written. Job doesn't seem to be concerned about seeing who he's going to leave his camels with, or who he's going to leave his cattle with, or who's going to get his house, or who's going to get his money, or all of this stuff. That's not mentioned, because it's pretty well gone. But even so, Job's physical condition makes that irrelevant in his thinking. What Job is, the loose ends, that if Job is trying to tie up loose ends, the loose ends are this: who is going to represent me to God? Because I'm fixing to face God. God has struck me down, and when I die, I will face Him. Now, it's a bit of irony here in these three or four verses. Let's read verses 1 and 2. My spirit is broken, my days are extinguished, the grave is ready for me. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes upon their provocation. Now notice in verse 3, he's speaking to God. Lay now, some versions say, O God, or O Lord, a pledge for me with thyself. Who is there that will be my guarantor? It seems like Job is asking and requesting that God may help him when he faces God. Now that's a kind of an ironic approach, but our ironic thought that he would say, oh God, help me when I face you. God, be my witness. Be my witness, be my advocate when I come and face you in judgment. He speaks to God in verses 3 and 4. Notice what he says in verse 4. And here again is where I'm seeing this thoughts flitter back and forth. Verse 4, he says, For God, you have kept their heart from understanding. And I would take that to mean you have kept their heart being, excuse me, being his friends. You have kept them from understanding my situation. You've kept my friends from understanding where I'm at. Therefore, you will not exalt them. And then in verse 5 is another unique statement that seems to disjointed a little bit. Because here he goes to, I don't know if hypothetical person is the right word, but it's not necessarily talking about his friends. It's talking a bit of wisdom, like a proverb. This sounds like something that would come and you'd find in the Proverbs. He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children also shall languish. Now I read that, and I think, what does that have to do with Job's life? What does that have to do with the previous three or four verses? And I don't know. I just don't know. But I'll give you a couple thoughts, and they may or may not be relevant. I don't know. But remember back in the first chapter or two of Job, his first friend, I think it was Eliphaz, when Eliphaz first began to speak, he told us something about Job that we didn't know. That Job, you have helped those around you. I'm going to see if I can find it. I should have looked it up. That's the way I always do things. Chapter 4 and verse 3 and 4. Job chapter 4, 3 and 4. Eliphaz is saying this. Behold, you have admonished many. Job, you have admonished many. You have strengthened weak hands. Your words have helped the tottering to stand. And you have strengthened weak or feeble knees. We found out from those two verses something about Job as a man. Job was a man that the scriptures call or describe as apt to teach. We're familiar with those three words from the New Testament in the book of 1 Timothy, I think, where it gives the qualifications for an elder. And one of the things that it says is he is apt to teach. And we've talked about this before in other contexts, but when the text says he is apt to teach, it doesn't mean he has the spiritual gift of teaching. It means that you're just liable to learn something from him. He will teach you things just as an ordinary walking through life. You will learn something from this man. I think that is a great quality to have. For a person to go through life and whoever is in his sphere of influence, those people who are around him, it might be his kids, it might be his co-workers, it may be, who knows who it may be, someone in line at the grocery store, but your conversations are such that they have meaning. And people are just apt to learn something from you about life, about living. And I think that was the characteristic of Job's life that you can see back there in Job chapter 4. And I think it's possible that even in Job's despair. Even in Job's the last days, as far as he knows, of his life, that characteristic that is comes natural for him is coming out even here. He makes the statement, "He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children will languish." Now, what does that mean? A couple of possibilities, and I don't know, again, I'm telling you another, I don't know what it means. But one possibility is this, that this man sells out. This man has friends, and for financial gain, he throws his friends under the bus in some way. All right, he does them dirty in a business deal, whatever the case may be, but he does something against his friends that's offensive to his friends for gain, ill-gotten gain. And Job tells us, and that may be what his friends are doing. Maybe he suspects they have ill motives in this comforting situation that they are coming to him with. But Job points out something that we can learn, even here. A person who is that way, he says, the eyes of his children also languish. In other words, as a general principle, a person who is a thief, a person who is a cheat, a person who is selfish, a person who is after ill-gotten gain, as a general principle, the consequences of those things will eventually catch up to them. It may be that it catches up to them in the lives of their children. Their children may suffer poverty. Their children may find themselves in the overflow of God's judgment on the parent. How many times have you, not that you're an evil person, but you've made a bad decision as an adult? And that bad decision, whether it was ignorantly or whether it was consciously, maybe it was just out of ignorance, or maybe it was just a selfish decision, but the consequences of it didn't just affect you. It affected your family. It affected your children. Now maybe that's what Job is saying. I'm just not sure. But Job brings this out in this chapter here. Then we go to number 2. This is verses 6 to 9. Made a statement here, the righteous will prevail except for me. Look at verses 6 through 9. In verse 6, Job says, "He has made me a byword of the people, and I am one at whom men spit." Job has brought out thoughts like this before, and here we see it again. Job looks around him, and he sees the community that surrounds him, the people that know him, and he sees their eyes upon him. He knows what they're thinking. And we've seen what they're thinking prior to this. His three friends think this same thing. Job perhaps would have had the same mentality if it had been someone else. But here's Job. Something is going on in Job's life. Job is not quite as righteous and holy as we thought. And Job's reputation, unjustly, takes a nosedive. He is looked at from those around him as, he says, a byword. I'm scorned. I'm looked down upon by those around me. Look at one as one who people would just spit at. Verse 7, "My eye has also grown dim because of grief, and all my members are as a shadow," describing his own physical appearance. "My eyes are dim because of grief." Maybe it's affected his eyesight, but his grief is so great, the pain is so great, that his physical body is wasting away. He says, my members are but a shadow of what they previously were when I was healthy. And then in verse 8 and 9, again, is a little bit of this, the other side of the coin, or perhaps something is coming out that Job really believes. The upright shall be appalled at this. The upright, the just person, in looking at this situation, would be appalled to think that this is what has happened. He says, the innocent shall stir himself up against the godless. Nevertheless, notice verse 9, the righteous shall hold to his way, and he who has clean hands shall grow stronger and stronger. Would Job have classified himself as a person who had clean hands? It seems like it to an extent. I mean, Job would not admit that he was perfected, but he's proclaimed his innocence all along here, hasn't he? And here he tells us, again, a general principle, a proverb. The righteous, the person who has clean hands, will grow stronger and stronger. But not for him. Seems like Job believes in that principle, and he states it for us, and yet it's not happening in his life. And then we come to the third point, and I've called this whatever. That's a new word. It's not a new word. It has a new meaning. And I like that word. I like the new usage of it. Sometimes I'll tell it to Susan. You know, we'll be discussing and debating whether to do this or whether to do that. And eventually I'll say, whatever. Now, what am I saying with that word? What is she hearing? What? Okay. Have it your way. That's a pretty good summary of it. Okay. The word, if you just look at the word, I could claim to be saying, I have no opinion. I have no will. You know, I'm okay with whatever, right? I'm okay to do it your way. I'm okay to do it my way, all right? But is that what I mean when I say that? No, that's not what I mean. When I say whatever, what I mean is we're going to do what you want to do. Don't think that bothers me. What makes you think I care? Right? That's what I mean. And she knows what I mean because I make sure I say it in such a way that she gets my point across. Now, I don't know if that's what Job is saying here, but in verse 10, and I wish I had brought some other translations to read it in different ones, but Job, in speaking to his friends, he says, but come again, all of you now. All right? Does anybody have the NIV? Carol, what does your verse say?
It says, but come on, all of you, try again.
Okay, that word, those two words, try again. It seems like Job is telling his friends, looks at his friends and say, okay, come on. Give me some more advice. Do it again, try again. You know, tell me again. But it seems like to me that he's saying it with that whatever sense. You know, I can just talk to you till I'm blue in the face and, you know, it does no good. So go ahead and say what you want to say. My spirit is broken. My days are nearly ended. The grave awaits me. Whatever. Verse 11. And you can see at the end of verse 10, he kind of points that out. Come again, all of you now. the last part of verse 10, for I do not find a wise man among you. So just talk. You know, there's not a wise man among you. None of you three have anything worth listening to, so just talk. Just have your spiel, whatever. And then in verse 11, compare that to verse 1. Verse 11 says, my days are past. In verse 1, you can see my days are extinguished. Verse 11, you see my plans are torn apart. Now the other two phrases are not going to be similar, but they still have the same mindset. It reveals to us the mindset. Verse 11, my plans are torn apart, even the wishes of my heart. And in verse 1, we saw my spirit is broken. The grave is ready for me. Verse 11, we see that the same mentality, a different approach, different angle on Job's spirit. It says, all the plans that I had in life are just ripped to shreds. They are torn apart. Even the desires of my heart. The plans I had, the desires of my heart, the longings that I had for the things to accomplish have just been dissipated. They are gone. And that's what happens when a person's spirit is broken. He says, verse 12 of his friends, they make night into day, saying, the light is near in the presence of darkness. He says it's like in the middle of the night, and they say it's light. And anybody can see it's not light, it's dark. And I've tried to think of a good example of this, but sometimes when you're in a bad situation and it seems like you're at the end of your rope and someone tries to be positive, you know, and they want to say something to make you feel better, and they end up saying something that's just a lie. You know, I mean, it's just not real. And it doesn't make you feel good. It makes you want to say, would you just shut up? You know, it's just not right. And Job seems to be pointing out his friends may be that way. So this is night. Darkness surrounds me. I'm engulfed in darkness, and you're telling me that it's light? Whatever. Whatever. Verse 13, he says, if I look for Sheol, or if I look for the grave. Now, this is some hypothetical statements here. If I do this. If I look for Sheol, or I'm going to use the word grave. If I look for the grave, if I look for my grave as my home. I've never had that thought before. If I look at my grave as my abode, if I look at my tomb, if I look at my casket as where I would live, this is my home. If I make my bed in the darkness, if I call out to the pit in which I am placed, the grave, the hole in the ground, if I call out to the pit and I say to the pit, you are my father. What kind of thinking does that take? Despair, discouragement, disillusion. If I call out to the pit and say, oh pit, you're my father. Or if I call out to the worms, what worms is this? The worms who are coming will be there eventually to eat his flesh. If I say to the worms, you are my mother, you are my sister. He ends the chapter, the last two verses, with some questions. Answer with me these questions, thinking of how Job feels. What answer is Job expecting? Where now is my hope? not to be found. And who regards my hope? Nobody. Who's looking upon my estate? Who's looking upon my life? Who's looking upon my situation? Nobody. I have no hope. Nobody is even noticing. Will my hope go down with me to Sheol? Will my hope be buried with me in the grave? Yes. Shall we go together down into the dust? Yeah. My hope and I will die together. We're gone. I've said it before in earlier chapters. I've never experienced such hopelessness as Job is experiencing. I don't know anybody who has. I don't doubt but what there are people. I don't doubt but what there are a number of people that I know or have known that really experienced hopelessness, that lived their life with a broken spirit. I haven't. And I haven't been paying enough attention to discern it in anybody else. That's not a virtue. That's not a good thing. But there is a world out there full of people who are hurting. A lot of it has been brought on their self. But sometimes it's just the fact that we live in a fallen world, and sin affects us. Let's be aware of those around us. Be aware of their situation. Be aware of their needs and help. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the study of this book. It is hard. Father, we tend to look at it as being something that is unreal, and I don't mean that it didn't happen, but it's so uncommon to our lives. Father, would you help us to see past the little surface conversations that we have with each other. And God, to be willing to not turn our head the other way when we come across those who are hurting. To not make light of it. To not deny it. But Father, to invest ourselves, Lord, in others' lives around us. God, to bear one another's burdens. Honor yourself with our lives. Amen.